Thanks very much for the invitation to come speak at this this wonderful institute. I feel like I've been treated very well so far, so thank you for the hospitality. I want to talk a little bit about boundary conformal field theory and anomalies in this trace of the stress tensor. And I'll tell you very shortly why I think that's an interesting and exciting subject. So the work I'm going to talk about is pretty recent. It's with my student, Kuo Wei Huang, who's sitting in the back of the back corner of the room today. He's been really key in all of this work, and he's looking for a postdoc, so hire him. And also, more recently, we've renewed a collaboration with Christian Jensen, who used to be a postdoc at the Yang Institute, but now has moved on to a faculty position. So this picture you're probably wondering about, it's a picture of a cross ratio. So a cross ratio in a conformal field theory, a boundary conformal field theory, and it's going to play a central role in today's talk. And it's a nice picture, so I figured I'd put it up front. And there's an important limit here in this contour plot of this cross ratio. So you see the axes x minus x prime and y prime, which are going to be the distance from the boundary, the y coordinate. And the point I'd like you to take away from this is that there's an interesting non-commuting of limits here. As I take y very small, it's kind of sensitive to whether I take the points close together first or not. Now, if I take the points close together first, I'm on these orange contours, which are a little bit smaller. And if I take the boundary limit first, I'm on these green contours, which are a bit larger. So just keep that in mind as we go forward. So what is my plan? I'm going to tell you why I think this is an interesting talk. I'm going to spend the first 5 or 10 minutes telling you why you should be excited about what I'm going to tell you. And then I'll tell you the results. So I'm going to review trace anomalies. What is the anomaly in the trace of the stress tensor? And especially in the context of boundary conformal field theory, I want to tell you some new results, which are relations between these boundary trace anomalies and 2 and 3 point functions of a special operator in boundary conformal field theory called the displacement operator, and an interesting consequence that one of these charges, I'll call it B2, can depend on marginal couplings, which should be interesting for those of you interested in these business about A theorems and C theorems and monotonicity and field theory under a normalization group flow. So that's my plan. And hopefully all of this, if it doesn't make sense now, will make sense in 60 minutes. So why is this exciting? So let me ask a question before I start out with. So what do D-brains, ADS-CFT, topological insulators, entanglement entropy for field theories, or many-body entanglement have in common? Tremendous developments in the field of high energy physics or theoretical physics more generally. What's true about all of these four subjects? And it's interesting, I think it's the importance of boundaries, right? In each of these four instances where there's been tremendous progress in theoretical physics, it's somehow boundaries, I think, that's underlied that progress. So D-brains, of course, they're boundary conditions for open strings, right? And what have D-brains given us? They've given us non-perturbative insight into string theories that led, say, to the second superstring revolution, realization that different string theories are just part of one larger picture. We can thank Polchinski, among many others, for that in the early 90s. ADS-CFT, what is this? So in this, right, we have, here's my picture of anti-de Sitter space, maybe with a black hole in it and some closed strings floating around. So anti-de Sitter space, we know, has a boundary, a conformal boundary. And it's at that conformal boundary where the dual field theory dual to that gravitational setup or string theory setup, lives. So again, there's a boundary here that's playing a critical role. And we know, of course, that there've been myriad developments from ADS-CFT in quantum gravity and strongly coupled field theories and understanding black holes, maybe perhaps best summarized by the fact that, at least according to Google Scholar, Maldacena's paper now has over 15,000 citations. Topological insulators. This is something I know much less about, but again, right, what is this? This is some insulating bulk material which has conducting surface states that are protected by symmetry, maybe discrete symmetries. So here are my Fermi C, and then there's some surface states which cross the Fermi energy and are massless in some effective field theory sense. And they predicted in the late 80s and really observed experimentally in real materials starting in about 07. And again, a really big development, I feel, in the field of theoretical physics and also experimental physics. And finally, entanglement entropy, which I know is important to several people in this room, at least. So developed in a quantum information sense, it's really taken off in the field theory or many body sense as well, where if you have, say, a lattice or maybe some continuum limit of a lattice, you can imagine partitioning your Hilbert space with respect to spatial regions on that lattice. And then once you do that, once you introduce the notion of a partition of the Hilbert space with respect to spatial regions, there's a boundary. There's a boundary between those two spatial regions. And again, in a lot of the work on entanglement entropy, you'll see that boundary playing a really critical role. And as we know, entanglement entropy has led to these new proofs of the A and C theorems for a normalization group of field theories in 2 and 4 dimensions. It's also given new perspectives to black hole physics and entropy and so forth. But in all of these cases, it's boundaries. So taking that insight for granted, where should we spend our effort? What should we look at? And I think one target of opportunity here is boundary conformal field theory. So would all of these developments just have been obvious if we understood quantum field theory in the presence of a boundary a little bit better to begin with? Let's say yes. So let's try to do this. Where should we start? Well, maybe one obvious place to start is with conformal field theories, which we know are the fixed points of RG flow. So instead of putting a boundary in an arbitrary quantum field theory, let's put it in a conformal field theory and try and understand the fixed points, sort of the map out the space of quantum field theories, but now with a boundary. So let's think about quantum conformal field theories with boundaries. So what's known about that? There's Cardy's work. I should really probably have an extra bullet point here due to John Cardy, which goes back to the 80s. A lot of very significant work for boundary conformal field theory in 2 dimensions. But I would say that if you go higher than 2D, it's surprisingly unexplored. You go back to, say, 93 or 95, there are these two key papers by McCavity and Osborne where they look at the constraints of conformal symmetry on correlation functions in conformal field theories. And I think these are really foundational, very key, important papers. And yet, they have fewer than 100 citations each, at least according to Google Scholar. Maybe that's not the metric we should be using, but it's at least suggestive that maybe there's more to do here. So what do I mean by boundary conformal field theory? So as I go forward, I'm really going to have two distinct things in my head. One is conformal field theory in flat space, and I'm just going to introduce a planar boundary that breaks the SOD, two conformal, full conformal invariance down to some subgroup, SOD minus 1, 2. And I'm also going to have in mind a curved space generalization where the space is curved and the boundary could also be curved. But the theory remains vial invariant. It's invariant under rescalings of the metric, both with respect to bulk terms and terms that might live on the boundary of my spacetime. So that's the setup I want to look at. So comments or complaints about whether this is a correct or incorrect take on the current state of theoretical physics? Okay, so you're all enthusiastic and converted to my point of view, at least for the next 50 minutes. So the stress tensor trace. So I want to talk about anomalies in the trace of the stress tensor. So it turns out that when you introduce a boundary into a conformal field theory, there are potentially new terms that appear in the trace of the stress tensor. So why are there terms there at all? So classically, we know we have this vial invariance and invariance under rescaling of the metric. It implies a conserved current, which we could maybe write schematically in this form, the stress tensor contracted with a coordinate. And then if it's conserved, what does it mean? Well, it means two things. It means that the sum of these two terms vanishes. But this term is guaranteed by diffeomorphism invariance, which I'll assume. And so we're left concluding that classically, at least, the trace must vanish too. But we know that's not quite true. And then there's this well-known story, at least in even dimensions, which I'll now try to quickly review. So probably most people in the audience are familiar with the two-dimensional case for two-dimensional conformal field theories. If we take the trace of the stress tensor on a curved manifold, it's proportional to the Ricci scalar times this central charge C. And that central charge C is sort of a critical component in our understanding, I think, of conformal field theories in two dimensions. It's also the coefficient of this stress tensor two-point function. There's this famous homologic of C theorem from the 80s, which tells us that under RG flow, if we flow from one 2D CFT to another, the value of the C must decrease. Then more recently, there are these entanglement entropy proofs. Entanglement entropy proof by Huerta and Cassini, arguing for a sort of analogous C quantity. It's not quite the same during the RG flow, but at the fixed points it agrees, it's also monotonic under RG flow. And so, you know, one key thing that emerges from this is you get kind of a sense of the map of two-dimensional CFTs, right? You can begin to sketch out how different CFTs are related to each other under RG flow. And so it's really quite a critical result. In 4D, the think story gets substantially more complicated. We have potentially three terms, something that's proportional to the Weyl curvature squared, which multiplies a central charge C, something that's proportional to the Euler density. I'll call that central charge A. It's just convention. And there's also a scheme-dependent term, which depends on how you regularize your theory, and that I'm just going to ignore for the purposes of today's talk. So C here, just like it was in 2D, is also the coefficient of the stress tensor two-point function. But it's A that replaces C in 4D as some sort of monotonic quantity under RG flow. There's this conjecture from Cardi in the 80s, later more recently proved about 6 years ago by my colleague at Stony Brook and Adam Schwimmer, that again, under RG flow, A decreases. And again, that quite recently, this year in fact, an entanglement entropy proof of that same quantity. So here again, you have some sort of beginnings of a map of the space of 40 QFTs. So trace anomaly in 6D, I guess, is largely uncharted. Now there are four terms that appear. There's some hints from supersymmetry in ADS-CFT of a similar 6DA theorem, but as far as I know, no similar proof. And so that's why this transparency is largely blank. And as you can continue to go up, maybe if you could find such CFTs in higher dimensions, there would be, you know, an increasing number of these curvature invariants, increasing number of these central charges. But as you notice, there's nothing in odd dimension. And so far, I haven't introduced a boundary. So this is what happens when you add a boundary, at least in relatively low dimensions. So here we have 2D to 6D. And I've introduced a new quantity here, the extrinsic curvature, which depends on the boundary. And not just that, but a k-hat term where I've removed the trace of that extrinsic curvature. So in 2D, or indeed in any manifold with a boundary, the Euler density gets more complicated, right? There, in addition to a bulk contribution to the Euler density, there's also a boundary contribution. And so in 2D, in addition to having some bulk guy, I also have to have this extrinsic curvature piece on that lives on the boundary to give me the Euler invariant for the corresponding two-manifold. Some of you may recognize that as the usual Einstein-Hilbert plus Gibbon-Hawking's term. There's no real, that's not really a coincidence. But that's what it is in 2D. And so for the purposes of this talk for today, the 2D case is somewhat uninteresting because there's no new central charge. There's just C. I'm interested in new central charges. And to see those, I have to go to higher dimension. And so I'm mostly going to focus on the 3D and the 4D case. So in the 3D case, without a boundary, there's nothing. The trace anomaly is going to vanish. But in the presence of a boundary, we have these two new potential terms that show up that are Weyl invariant that could satisfy some Wessamino consistency conditions. And so I can label their coefficients. I'll label them as A and B going forward. Similarly, in 4D, well, I have my old bulk terms. And I've also got to add a boundary term for that Euler density. I won't write it down explicitly. But in addition to that, those bulk terms, I have two new charges as well, one which multiplies an extrinsic curvature cube, and another which multiplies this Kw guy. And then we can continue to go up, and the number of these charges begins to proliferate. And I think starting in 5D, I don't even know what the full classification is here that satisfies West amino consistency conditions and is viral invariant. So there's lots of open territory here. So what I'm going to focus on today is just the 3D and the 4D case. So a couple of things are known. One is a nice paper by my collaborator Jensen, along with his collaborator O'Bannon, that coefficient A, again, should be monotonic in some sense. That AUV is greater than AIR. And then there's this interesting conjecture. So a number of these coefficients were computed for free theories going back to the late 80s and early 90s. And so you can just look at some small data set and try and look for any interesting coincidences, sort of numerical experiments. And you find that for free theories, it's always true that this B2 is 8 times in this normalization, 8 times this C coefficient. So it's related to the stress tensor two-point function. So this is true for free theories, and these gentlemen conjectured it might be true in general. So I'm not going to have a whole lot to say about A today, but we are going to be able to disprove, I think, this conjecture that B2 is equal to 8C in general. And we'll see why it will also, as a byproduct, see why it was true for free theories. All right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. By xn, you mean the coordinate that is vanishing on the boundary?
That's right, yeah. So I have in mind, yeah, I guess it wasn't obvious. So I have my boundary, which is parameterized by xn equals 0, and my space lives to the right for positive xn. Other questions?
There's a typo, I think, in the second line.
There's a typo in the second line. Uh-oh. Where?
I mean, delta is just for k, right?
No, it's both. So this is the intrinsic curvature that lives on the boundary. It's the intrinsic scalar curvature associated with the, in this case, 2D boundary. These are both boundary terms. There is no bulk term in 3D in odd dimensions. Yes, thank you for that question.
Why is it called B-theor when it relates?
Because they called it B, and I think they wanted it to be like a boundary theorem. There was already an A theorem and a C theorem, so they could have a B theorem that was in between. I think it makes sense probably just to call all of these coefficients A, or Euler density terms, because they all multiply an Euler density of one sort or another. Okay.
Sorry, what is x perpendicular?
Yeah, so I guess that is a typo. So xn is x perpendicular. Thank you. I should fix that. OK. Anything else? OK, so what I'm going to tell you that's new today, so to the physics, can we say anything more about these four guys, these four boundary coefficients? So the answer in the 3D case for this k squared guy is yes, and also in the 4D case for B1 and B2. And I'll also show you a conjecture for A, although I can't prove it. I don't know. I don't really know the full story here. And what I'm going to tell you is that I can relate these coefficients to correlation functions of an operator called the displacement operator. It's the operator sourced by varying the embedding equation. So if I think about xn as a source for an operator, the operator dual to that is what I call the displacement operator. How does this work in detail? So this is what I just said in words. In the context of BCFT, I have conservation of the stress tensor in the bulk. But because I've broken translation invariance, I'm going to lose momentum conservation perpendicular to the boundary, right? And so in principle, in addition to having conservation of momentum parallel to the boundary, I have the possibility of having some delta function source multiplied by some operator that just lives on the boundary. So it turns out that this guy and this guy are the same by basically a Ward identity, but I'm not going to prove today. And then we can go a little bit further. We can think about, you know, your standard capacitor plate argument in your first year physics course to, you know, identify a charge density with an electric field. And by integrating this equation on the boundary, you can see that the normal component of the stress tensor, the boundary limit of that guy, is exactly the displacement operator, up to maybe equations of motion, but there's an operator level identity there. So several different ways of thinking about the displacement operator. And they're going to be, those different interpretations will be important as we go on. So here are the results. So since this operator lives just in the boundary, and I have a conformal invariance associated in that boundary, I know what the 2 and 3 point functions are of the displacement operator. They're fixed by the conformal symmetry. They just take the usual forms. I have to scale as a length to the 2D power, since I know the dimension of that displacement operator is just the dimension of the space-time. And the 3 point function similarly is constrained by conformal symmetry up to these constants, CNN and C triple N, let's call them. So what I'm going to argue as we go forward is that B is related to CNN, that B1 is related to the 3 point function, and that in 4D, this B2 is also related to the 2 point function of the displacement operator. The argument I'm going to use is analogous. If you've read this paper by Osborne and Petku from 1993, it's almost identical to that argument, but adapted to a field theory with a boundary. And it's going to fail. I can't use this in the A case because R is topological. I'm going to wind up varying these guys with respect to, say, a metric or something. And when I vary that, I don't get anything. I just get a total derivative. I don't learn anything, at least at leading order, for what the correlation functions of the displacement operator or the stress tensor are. So I can't get anything in that case. So rest of the talk, I'll tell you where these come from, what about this conjecture that B2 equals 8C, and a little bit about this conjecture for the quantity that's supposed to be monotonic. Okay, we start. Okay. So B for in 3D. So I have this trace k hat squared, traceless part of extrinsic curvature multiplying B. And what I can do, so that's in the trace. And my theory is scale invariant. And so if I integrate that up, I can get an effective action that will generate that anomalous term in the trace of the stress tensor. And the piece of the action that will give me that anomalous part, I can write in the following way. I is trace k hat squared, again, times some scale quantity mu, raised to some small quantity epsilon over epsilon. And we're going to vary that with respect to the scale or the mu, and that will produce the same trace case trace hat k squared in the trace of the stress tensor. Okay. If I'm very close to a plane, and x, the deviations from planarity are very small, I can expand out the extrinsic curvature in terms of derivatives of the embedding function. So just two derivatives, dA, dB of xn. And so this is something that's quadratic in xn. So it looks like I can get something that's a two-point function for displacement. And now I'm going to vary this twice with respect to xn, and that's going to give me some piece of the displacement two-point function. It's not going to give me the full thing because this is already in a coincident limit. I can't really learn anything about the correlation function from this guy away from a coincident limit, but I can learn something about its singular contribution. So I vary twice, and clearly I'm going to get something that's fourth order in derivatives and then multiplied by a delta function, and it's also proportional to this central charge B. Okay. So at the same time, I know that the correlation function for D is frozen by conformal invariance to have this form CNN over x to the 6. So the displacement operator has a dimension that's protected by the conformal symmetry. So it has to be dimension 3 in 3 dimensions. It has to go as x to the 6. And what I want to do is I want to relate the singularity in this as x gets small to this singular or distributional piece here that I got from my effective action. But I go back, say, to the early 90s. There's this paper by Friedman, Johnson, and Latour who tell me how to do this real space regularization or renormalization, that instead of writing the two-point function as 1 over x to the sixth, I can write it in this regulated form where I introduce the scale mu. And now you can just check if I take these three three Laplacians on this guy, I'll get 1 over x to the sixth. But at the same time, I can also look at the scale variation of this. I can take mu d mu of this quantity, and I'm going to get a delta function times box squared, basically because the Laplacian acting on a logarithm is a delta function. And then I can just match the corresponding coefficient here, CNN, to the corresponding trace anomaly coefficient B. And that will give me my constraint. But it's an analogous argument was used by Osborne and Petku back in 93 to relate the two-point function of the stress tensor to the coefficient of the W squared term in the trace anomaly. It's almost identical. Their argument is a bit more complicated because there's a bunch of extra tensor structure, but it's basically the same argument. Okay, so I'm not going to show you the same level of detail for the next example, but is this clear? Clear enough.
Sorry, can you?
Yeah.
Is mu is regulating what divergence is?
The divergence is x goes to zero. The UV divergence and the coincident limit. Yeah. So let's go up back to four dimensions, where I have a similar looking term that's trace k hat cubed that multiplies b1. And again, I can have an effective action where I introduce some artificial scale mu. And now when I vary the scale, I'm going to get a contribution to the trace of the stress tensor, which is again proportional to trace k hat cubed. And now this is going to be third order in my embedding equation xn. So I can take three derivatives and get something that's going to tell me about a coincident limit of the three-point function of the displacement operator. So this was not immediately obvious. It's not immediately obvious how to regulate this. But it turned out there was a nice recent paper by Skenderis, McFadden, Bozowski from 13, where they show how to Fourier transform this, basically. From the Fourier transform, you can figure out how to appropriately regulate it, introduce some scale. And then from this paper, it's a short hop, skip, and a jump to relate CNNN to B1. So I'm not going to show you those messy details, but it's the same computation as we saw in the previous slide. So that's two. So we've done B and we've done B1, and we've related the central charges to correlation functions of the displacement operator. So the next example is much more complicated. And my arguments here are not airtight. I give you my best shot at it. I wish I could show you something a little bit stronger, but we'll see what happens. Okay, so in principle, I could decide to work, say, not in flat space, but in some curved background where I have a Weyl curvature, and now I want to look at, say, a one-point function of this displacement operator. That's not the approach I'm going to use. What I'm going to do is something a bit more roundabout. So I'm going to look at two terms in the effective action, one which generates this Kw term on the boundary, and one which generates the W squared term in the bulk, the coefficient of C. And roughly speaking, what I want to do is I want to vary both of these now, not with respect to the embedding equation or embedding variable, but with respect to the metric, with respect to small fluctuations in the metric. So I vary this twice, and I vary this twice, and that's some stress tensor two-point function, or the coincident limit of some stress tensor two-point function now. And what I want to argue is that there's a boundary term in this variation, since I'm now working on a manifold with boundary, that I need to cancel against this guy, okay? So naively, you would say, okay, great, that tells me that B2 and C are related. And probably this conjecture by Soloducan and friends is correct, that B2 is equal to 8C. But there's a subtle order of limits issue, which I believe spoils that. And let me show you how that works. Okay, so I have to develop a little bit more of the story here. So in without a boundary, the two-point function of the stress tensor is relatively simple. It's fixed up to some unique tensor structure by the conformal invariance. In particular, it's this tensor structure sitting here in this rather lengthy expression. I'm not going to tell you what that tensor structure is in detail. But when I have a boundary, I've got less symmetry, and therefore there's more possibilities of things to write down that depend also on how far you are or that normal direction from the boundary. And so there's two extra tensor structures that show up. And they all depend on a single function, alpha of a cross ratio, v. This is that same cross ratio I believe I showed you on the first slide. Yep. And okay, so what do I want to say? So I've got two limits. So alpha, if I take the limit where v goes to 0, that's the limit where the numerator vanishes, where the two points get close together. So the boundary looks like it's very far away. The boundary has very limited effect on what's going on. And I recover the usual conformal field theory case without a boundary. So I'll just recover the first term here. There's another limit, v goes to 1, where this function alpha can, in principle, take some other value. OK? And I'm going to focus just on this term. I mean, these terms are, in principle, important. But I'd like to argue that they can't cancel this boundary term that I'm interested in. They have the wrong tensor structure to cancel the boundary term. So I can focus just on that first term in this expression. OK, so I have this effective action that's generating the w squared term in the trace. And what I want to say is that to reproduce the scale dependence of the two-point function in the boundary limit, b goes to 1, I need to use this effective action with a different value of c. Otherwise, I'm not going to reproduce this guy here with the right coefficient. There's, if you wish, a sort of a boundary layer. If I get very close to the boundary, there's a boundary layer where c has to take a different value in order to match the right behavior of the two-point function. And if I look, so if I change c so I can match the boundary limit of the two-point function, and then I vary it, and then I cancel that boundary term against the contribution from B2, that's going to lead to a relation not between alpha of 0 or the coincident limit of the stress tensor, but alpha of 1 or the boundary limit of the stress tensor. It'll lead to a relation between alpha of 1 and B2. But that alpha of 1, if you trace through those tensor identities, is nothing but CNN. That alpha of 1 is, in this notation, the coefficient of the displacement operator two-point function. So there's this subtle order of limits that I was hinting at the beginning, and I'm not doing a terrific job of explaining it. And part of that is I don't think my argument is airtight. But this is what I think happens, that you need to cancel alpha of 1. You need to cancel the boundary term with a slightly different value of c that's tuned to get the boundary limit of the stress tensor against this boundary trace coefficient, this B2. So there's a relation between alpha 1 or CNN and B2. OK, so we can then check it, at least for free fields. And so as I was saying before, a number of these trace anomalies were computed for free fields using heat kernel methods 15 or 20 years ago. And then recently, there's been kind of a resurgence of interest in computing these quantities. So we can look at, for example, in 3D, we can look at a scalar field. That's what S equals 0, or fermions. That's what S equals a half means. And these values agree, computed with heat kernel methods, they agree with our displacement operator computations. Or you can look at B1 for a scalar or a fermion, or even for a gauge field, because now we're in 4D, and a U1 gauge field in 4D is conformally invariant. And again, these match with the corresponding displacement operator computations. And then you can also check that B2 equals 8C for the conformal, for the free fields. The displacement operator computations give what they should. So why can we get a deeper understanding of why for free fields you find this relation, whereas in general it may not be true? So my heuristic understanding is that for free fields, this function alpha v basically has two contributions. It's got a contribution one, which is what you get for a theory without a boundary. You just get that leading term in the stress tensor two-point function with a constant coefficient. And then if you have a boundary, it's as if you have also a mirror image point for one of the stress tensors. So you have to add the effect of the image point on the other side of the boundary. And that's going to come with this funny cross ratio v to the 2d power. So because of this effect, this sort of method of images approach to alpha v, basically all free theories have this kind of structure. You see for all free theories that twice alpha of 0 is alpha of 1, that there's some correlation between the boundary and bulk values of the two-point function of the stress tensor for free theories. And by the old Osborne and Petku argument, alpha of 0 is that central charge C. So if you just trace through, look at all the coefficients of proportionality, at the end of the day, you find this relation B2 equals 8C, just by sort of method of images analysis. But this looks kind of suspicious. I mean, this looks kind of like there's some linearity at work. There's some sort of free field argument at work behind this kind of a structure. It looks like it should be pretty easy to violate in general, that 2 alpha of 0 is not alpha of 1. So what about interactions? Well, one theory we can look at, because it's been looked at in detail over the years, is 5-4 scalar field theory, maybe starting in 4D and moving away from it in some epsilon expansion. So McCavity and Osborne, for example, looked at this theory. And they showed both in an epsilon expansion and at large n, if you have a large number of n of these five fields, that this relation is violated. It's not true. Two alpha of the bulk is not alpha of the boundary. The downside of this example, which is where a lot of the effort has gone into over the years for these boundary conformal field theories, is that I want to make a statement about these boundary central charges in four dimensions, right? And Wilson Fisher, as I go to the 4D limit, becomes free. And in the free theory, we've already established that B2 equals 8C. So I don't really have a counterexample yet. I have an example where this relation is violated, but I don't have a relation yet in 4D where B2 is not equal to 8C. Okay? So I need some more examples. And maybe some people in the audience have some other easy examples to suggest. But let me tell you about my favorite so far, which is this mixed dimensional QED. So I kind of dreamed this up sitting at my desk one day and then realized that I was not the first by any means to have dreamed it up. As a lengthy history going back at least 20 years and probably further. So the idea is very simple. Have a 4D photon and a 3D fermion that lives on my boundary. And the fermion is charged, and so it's going to interact via this four-dimensional photon by exchanging these 4D photons. And I want some kind of boundary condition which makes this non-trivial. So I want the normal tangential component of the gauge field to be related to the fermion current. That's basically the gauge field, or that's a boundary condition that comes naturally out of a variational principle for that action. So this theory has a number of fairly remarkable properties. There's a relation to graphene. So what is graphene? Graphene, in some effective field theory language, it's a theory of electrons in the plane that interact via some 4D photon. And the dispersion relation for the electrons is relativistic. So they naively, it seems like it's exactly this until you realize, well, actually, the photons are moving much faster than the electrons to start out with. But then you can maybe compute a beta function for the speed of the electrons, and you find that you know, these simple models of graphene that people have come up with over the years, for example, by Sun, there's a beta function for the speed of the electrons, which runs to the speed of light at long distances. And so you could think of this theory as some ultimate IR limit of graphene. Of course, experimentally, I think you're always very far from this limit, but nevertheless, there is that sort of tantalizing connection to experiment. Another fascinating thing about this is the beta function for G vanishes perturbatively. I'll say a few more words about this in a minute. And so basically at all orders in G, it vanishes. And so I have a line of conformal field theories. And so I can actually do perturbative computations here at some small value of G in four dimensions. That's why it's going to be important for us in a minute. There are other interesting things I might point out just in passing about this theory. It has an interesting behavior under S-duality. There's a nice paper by Sun and Shao from May of this year. I should add Shao's name here. So using S-duality, they can actually compute a current-current correlation function at the fixed point of the S-duality, and from that get a conductivity for such a theory. And at large NF, if you have a lot of fermions, there's a close relationship between the Feynman diagrams of this theory and the Feynman diagrams of QED3, for those of you who are interested in like issues of chiral symmetry breaking in QED3. So there's a long list of very interesting aspects to this theory that I became aware of after I started looking at the literature a little bit. Yeah. It's a family of conformally invariant.
The conditions for the free theory.
For the photon that's free in the bulk, yeah. The theory living on the boundary is not free.
There is no theory living on the boundary. It's a four-dimensional theory in a quantum condition.
Well, I think there is a sense in which you have an interacting theory living on the boundary.
No. So theory, by definition, theory is something that lives on its own, not coupled to something else. At least in the term, in the meaning of the term, it's called theory. Yes, there is a four-dimensional theory with a boundary condition, conformally invariant. I mean, boundaries, you can call it boundaries FT, boundary theory, but it's not a
Okay. I don't know. I'm still a little bit. I mean, it seems like you can learn about QED3 at large NF from this theory. So then you're learning about the theory, which is very similar, which is conformally invariant.
It's not a 3D theory in any sense. It's a 4D theory and a 3D boundary condition for it.
Yes.
There are some values of G such that it decouples, let's say.
Yeah, G equal to zero.
Or G to infinity.
Sure, if you go to the cusps.
So, in this theory, is there a complete base of boundary states?
I believe so.
Now, you can reconstruct all correlation functions using boundary states.
Yeah, I believe so. I guess we should continue with the later. I don't know. Or boundary operators. There's a decomposition of two-point functions into boundary operators. So at any rate, so I wanted to talk about this particular aspect. So why is it exactly conformal? Various arguments. Here's one that I like. So there's a usual Ward identity for QED, which relates the fermion wave function renormalization to the vertex renormalization. So that drops out of the beta function. The beta function is just determined by the photon renormalization. But then we can think about what happens to the photon. I think there are two arguments out there. One is very quick. You just say, well, you know, you're away from the boundary. There's no way for the boundary to really renormalize the photon coupling. So it, it, it can't renormalize. Here's a slightly different one. We can actually look at the Feynman diagrams for the photon self-energy. They have a superficial degree of divergence that's 1. That's compared to 2 for the usual 4D QED case. And then there's this usual argument that the photon self-energy has this prefactor, which cuts down the superficial degree of divergence by 2, because it's quadratic in the momentum. And so as a negative superficial degree of divergence, it's not divergent. It's finite. So there's no renormalization. There's no renormalization of the photon wave function. So at any order in perturbation theory, this coupling G is not renormalized. Non-perturbatively, I don't know. OK, so then we can do computations. We can look, for example, in some fixed gauge. I like Feynman gauge. We can look at the two-point function of the vector potential. We have the usual term. And then there's a piece from the image. This would be the case where I have a Neumann boundary condition for these tangential components of the gauge field. And if I look at corrections to that, so I have to compute some kind of self-energy diagram. I think it's this one, which is finite. But even though it's finite, it affects the two-point function a little bit. It gives you a finite correction to the second term here. And so it's as if the two-point function has moved a little bit away from the Neumann condition. And then using that as a building block, you can then compute perturbatively composite operators like the stress tensor two-point function, at least a leading order in G squared. And so when you just plug that in, you see pretty much immediately that alpha of 1 is shifted away from twice alpha in the bulk by some order g squared amount. So that relationship is changed. And correspondingly, if you believe my argument about the boundary central charge, the boundary central charge has also moved away from, 8 times c. So in this case, both alpha 1 and b2 depend on exactly marginal couplings. Exactly marginal couplings in my CFT, which is, I think, very unlike the situation for the bulk charges A and C in 4D. So West amino consistency, if you're familiar with that argument, it basically forces A to be constant along marginal directions. So there's no way for A to change. And that's part of what makes A a good measure of RG flow. There's no such argument for C, but at the same time, I have no real counterexample of a conformal field theory in 4 dimensions where C can depend on a marginal direction. Most of the examples I know where I can compute C are supersymmetric. Once it's supersymmetric, C is fixed. It can't depend on marginal directions. So I don't know. It's interesting that here's an explicit example of a central charge that does depend on marginal directions. So I promised a conjecture for A. This is a bit of a disturbing conjecture, which leaves me a little bit uneasy about this whole enterprise for computing boundary contributions to the trace of the stress tensor. So this is if I look at the stress tensor two-point function, I was saying before there are these different tensor structures. So if I look at the tangential component, two of those structures appear. There's another structure that's you're not going to see in this particular tangential channel. And I've written the coefficients as in terms of alpha and epsilon. Now, alpha and epsilon, they're not really independent. They're related by current conservation. And you saw that on the previous slide. So I can write, epsilon is some second derivative, second order differential operator acting on alpha. So there's this term here which multiplies this tensor structure. So this one is the guy that appears when you don't have a boundary. This tensor structure, this is the same tensor structure that appears without a boundary, but in one dimension lower. So it's the structure that would appear for a 2D CFT. So maybe it's not surprising that since this appears in this tensor structure appears for a 2D CFT, whatever multiplies it should be that C coefficient for a 2D CFT. And indeed, for free theories, if I just evaluate V at 1, that coefficient shows up here. And this gives me my A boundary, my A3D coefficient, at least for free theories. I only really have 3 examples here where I've computed this. One is scalars with Dirichlet boundary conditions. One is scalars with Robin boundary conditions. One is free fermions. In those 3 cases, this works. And then I've, for the fun of it, I've really just added another term, if I could imagine, you know, some completely decoupled CFT that's just living on that boundary that could also potentially shift A, since it's really, in some sense, it really is the two-dimensional C we started out talking about 40 minutes ago. So that's a conjecture. And one thing that follows from it, since there's a reflection positivity argument that all of these coefficients, alpha, epsilon, and C, are all positive, and since alpha itself is related to the B central charge, from this you can see that this ratio is constrained, is bounded below by minus 2/3. And so that's sort of like these Hoffman-Maldacena collider bounds that people have talked about. The thing that kind of bothers me about this and makes me a little bit uneasy about this whole conjecture is that in principle, epsilon can be divergent at the boundary. And in fact, in say 5-4 scalar field theory, it is divergent in this epsilon expansion. And so I'm not quite sure how to interpret this term or what that divergence really means. Okay, so that's all I have to say, really. I have a quick summary and conclusion. Let me remind you what I told you. So we have these boundary central charges in 3 and 4 dimensions, and we've related them to 2 and 3 point functions of the displacement operator. So in particular, these three guys, plus this possible conjecture for A. We've argued in 4D that this relationship B2 equals 8C is special for free theories, and given a counterexample, this mixed QED. And in addition, this mixed QED theory, well, it provides a counterexample. It also provides an example where B2 depends on a marginal couplet, which I thought was kind of interesting. There's a whole bunch of stuff that one could think about generalizing, especially if one is excited about this whole sort of boundary conformal field theory program. I'd like to verify this proposal for B2 by actually computing it directly. Put mixed QED in some curved space, actually compute the trace of the stress tensor, make sure it is what I really said it is, that it's this displacement operator two-point function. All the boundaries I talked about today were codimension 1. It's, you know, easy to start thinking about higher codimension defects. This would be relevant, for example, for entanglement entropy computations, where, say, in 4D, maybe one wants to think about codimension 2 defects. What kind of constraints are they? Are there? We saw this bound for A that is a little bit like these Hoffman-Maldacena collider bounds. Can one be a little bit more rigorous? Are there other bounds that exist? Maybe one could constrain those by looking at higher point functions of the stress tensor. And there are lots of models where one could maybe begin to think about computing these quantities too. For example, in ADS CFT, these Janus solutions, which people have maybe just begun to think about a little bit, computed a few of these charges, but not too many. And there are also many other examples of free theories with conformal boundary conditions or theories with only boundary interactions like this mixed QED that one could begin to think about, things that look like Yukawa theories where the scalars or the fermions are constrained to live on the boundary. And then finally, there's this whole bootstrap, conformal bootstrap program, which maybe could be revisited in the context of these boundary central charges. What can we learn about these charges from the boundary bootstrap? And I think that's it. It's just this larger vision, right, of constraining QFTs by constraining CFTs and maybe providing a more local view of quantum field theory by figuring out how to deal with boundaries. So thanks very much. Yeah.
So normally in a boundary CFT, you can express this alpha v as a function of squares times Hoffman blocks.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you relate it to anomalies. So does that lead to interesting sum rules?
It might. I mean, all that I've done so far with Kuo Wei was this reflection positivity argument that I know that alpha v is positive. But more than that, we haven't really explored it.
Question? Actually, actually, I want to tell something. In this example where epsilon of 1 was divergent, I didn't quite understand if this means that A is ill-defined in this theory, or does it mean that, or is there an independent way of computing it, and this relation does it hold? Which of the two?
So epsilon, this question about whether the divergence in epsilon, what does that mean for this boundary coefficient A? And the simple answer is I don't know, and those are the questions that are bothering me. If epsilon diverges, should one just say that it's, you know, you regulate the divergence and it's just the, you know, some minimal subtraction, it's just the constant term which defines A, but is that really a well-defined prescription? I don't know.
So it's not like there is an independent calculation of A that gives a final answer?
I mean, this is a conjecture, so I hopefully there is. That independent calculation would resolve this question.
Is it obvious that in the two-point function of this tensor, in the presence of boundary, there would not be something that has power law, some anomalous power law behavior?
Anomalous power law behavior. I think there could easily be anomalous power law behavior in the stress tensor.
Yeah, it's an assumption that this doesn't happen.
That's sort of what I was saying with the behavior of epsilon. So, in some sense, I think about that epsilon is governing the spin two exchange, and all those spin two operators, their dimensions are not protected in any nice way. And yeah, so there could easily be no contribution from epsilon of one. In general, the fact that you get epsilon, some contribution from epsilon 1 could just be a free theory. Epsilon of 1 is, yeah, where they're colliding separately with the boundary, yeah.
Actually, principle alpha and epsilon might be more divergent.
Alpha, I think, is not divergent by the unit parity bound. Alpha is not divergent. Alpha of 1 can always get a contribution from the displacement operator whose dimension is conserved. But epsilon, in general, there doesn't need to be any contribution from epsilon of 1. It could easily be power law, yeah. And it could easily be, it is divergent in certain examples that I know.
Does epsilon by itself have some conformal block expansion? Oh, you said it's related to alpha, right?
There's really only one independent coefficient, but somehow for the dimension D operators, things break apart a little bit. So. Things that have the dimension of the displacement operator.
Is it obvious how things change, let's say, with the 3D with the boundary, if you just put a topological field theory, you just add a topological field theory to the bound?
I honestly haven't thought about it. I don't know. It sounds like an interesting question. I don't know.
I mean, one would wonder whether it's just a change of boundary conditions in some sense. I don't know.
In the context of the mixed QED, I have wondered a little bit about how things would change with Chern-Simons terms on the boundary, which may be related to your question.
You can just turn on it, also turn on the theta angle with the bound.
Hmm?
You can also turn on the theta angle with the bound. So
it's a theta angle, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a complex one dimensional fan.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't had time to think about
it. And then if it's delta goes to pi, it's like two dimensional sample.
Any other question? Not just step, let's be like that.